Welcome to episode 16 of the Walk and Talk podcast. I'm Greg Johnson, and today is Tuesday, May 12th, 2020. The topic for this podcast is going to be setting up a basic Windows computer. I'm not going to go into the step-by-step specific details of what you want to do, but this is the general overview of what I do when I'm setting up a Windows computer and some of the decisions that are made for the person who will be using it. So let's get started. The intended audience for this message is going to be the beginning user. And so this will provide sort of an orientation and some thought-inspiring or thought-provoking questions. You're likely listening to this after having already set up your Windows computer and perhaps been using it for a while, although there may be people out there who are just getting ready to unbox a computer and set it up and are listening to this guide as a resource. So let me just start from the beginning. When you're first powering on a Windows computer, you'll be walked through a basic setup process. When installing Windows from scratch, if there's no other software on the computer and you're just doing a fresh install of Windows, you'll get a very minimalist process at the beginning, and you'll basically just need to have a Microsoft account or to create one when you're going through the process. But when you buy a Windows computer from the store, if it's HP or Dell or some other brand, you'll notice there are some additional screens that'll show up asking you to accept license agreements, and there might be some pre-installed antivirus software, and they'll ask if it's okay to have your name and address forwarded to the antivirus software company. And there may be some other brand-specific screens that show up that aren't really related to Windows necessarily, but necessary to get the computer going. So you will notice during the setup process, most likely you'll be given an opportunity to select some privacy settings. And you could go ahead and turn off all of the privacy features or vulnerabilities, I guess you could say, and make the computer as private as possible. But those settings can also be changed later. There are some people that get sort of bogged down into the weeds of privacy settings for devices and computers, and some of those settings are necessary for you to interact with all the features of the computer. And for example, location information. So when you go to a weather website, it knows what city you're in, that kind of thing. And in the past, it was possible to set up a Windows computer without having a Microsoft account. But lately, as I've been setting up Windows 10 computers, I've not noticed, even in the fine print, any sort of escape plan from their insisting on that the user has a Microsoft account. So you can provide one or create one. It is useful to have your Windows computer synchronizing to a Microsoft account because some of the features can be backed up, some of the settings and preferences can be saved to the cloud. And if the computer were to crash, then you'd have some of those things already configured for you. With the new Microsoft Edge browser, the new version of that browser, you can have clippings, sort of like Microsoft OneNote, but applied to web browsing. And all of that depends on having the cloud services turned on. There is a free level of interaction with Microsoft. You get a little bit of cloud storage and an account, and you can buy software if you want. And then there's a paid version, which gives you more cloud storage and the Microsoft Office suite. But I'm mentioning all of that because if you're an existing Microsoft account holder, if you have an MSN email account or a Hotmail email account or an Outlook email account, that would tell you that you are an existing Microsoft account holder, or if you have at some point set up a Microsoft account using your Gmail address or something, then you're already part of their system. And if you're not, during the setup, you can create an account, which is basically just to provide an existing email or choose a new one and set a password. So in the process of setting up Windows, you will eventually arrive at the desktop, and it will look just like any other Windows desktop, but maybe some unique branding will be there. At the bottom of your computer screen, you'll have what's referred to as the taskbar. That's where you will see the icons for launching some programs with a single click. You'll notice that icons on the desktop area above the taskbar require two clicks to launch. So the first click selects the item, the second click launches it if you're clicking quickly. But on the taskbar in the lower area of your screen on the left side, that's referred to as the quick launch area, or it used to be in older versions of Windows. And now it's just called the taskbar. You can click and drag icons down there, or if a program is running, you can right-click and choose to pin it to that area. To the left of where you see those program icons, you'll see your start menu. Long time ago, it would say start, but now it's just a Windows icon in the lower left corner. If you click on that Windows icon and just start typing on your keyboard, you'll notice that as you're typing, a search box will come up. I often will tell people, click on the Windows menu and then type in Control Panel or something. And they'll say, oh, where do I type that? And so that's a natural reaction, would be to think that you need to be clicking in some box or typing in a box, but you don't. So that's a good trick to know about, a tip, which is to click on the start menu and search. Along the taskbar to the right side, you'll see an area with more icons, small icons on the right, and that's referred to as the system tray. It's where system programs are running, perhaps utilities or something else, and they sort of run all the time, so they're not a quick launch icon. They are an indication that something's running. That's an area of the screen to be mindful of, because if you were to get some malware, it may show up in that area of your screen. You'd see an unfamiliar icon down there. One of the first things we should do is take some screenshots of the computer as it is when it's new from the store, or even if you've had it now for a week or two or whatever, just kind of get a time capsule snapshot image visually of what's on the desktop, what's in the taskbar, what's in that quick launch area and the system tray, so you can reference back to that later. Also, you'll want to get a picture of what programs are installed. The reason for this is because, as I just mentioned a little while ago, you'll want to be able to identify any unrecognized or unfamiliar programs, anything that shouldn't be there. And the only way to know what shouldn't be there is to be familiar with what should be there. On older versions of Windows, you may have what's called the snipping tool. On newer, updated versions of Windows 10, you may have a program called Snip and Sketch that replaced the old snipping tool utility. And these will allow you to take a picture of the screen and save it to your hard drive. So let's find that right now. Go to the start menu if you're in front of your computer, or you can take a note or listen to this later when you are. But go to the start menu and type in snip and see if the snipping tool comes up, or type in capture and see if the new screen capturing utility comes up. Now, I won't go into the specifics of how to use these, but if you kind of poke around, it should be pretty intuitive how to create a new screenshot and then how to save it. So you'll want to take a picture of your desktop as it is. You notice when you click on your start menu, there are quite a few, depending on the size of your screen, something that looks like 1-inch square tiles, program shortcuts in your start menu. The intention here is to have commonly used programs easily available right there on your start menu. You'll notice some programs in the start menu that are not commonly used, and those you probably want to just go ahead and get rid of. You won't be removing the programs from the computer entirely. You're not uninstalling them, but you're just removing their shortcuts from the start menu to clean that up and make it more efficient. So to do that, you'll just right-click on any tile that you think you don't really need every day and choose Remove from Start Menu. And as you do that, you may find some tiles that are actually a group. So a common group of tiles would be the Microsoft Office suite of software. Even though you've not paid for it, it may not even be installed yet, but it's already in there. So if you click on it, you'll be asked to sign up. But you can remove that for now because it's unlikely you're going to be using every single program in the entire Office suite. You'll most likely use Word or Excel or PowerPoint. And you can have those icons later added to the start menu if you want. So that's something that's a bit of housekeeping that I would recommend at first. Also, depending on how your computer is configured, you may see a little text box area in the lower left of your screen. You may see that on the taskbar, like a search box. And that takes up quite a bit of room and is really unnecessary. So I would recommend that you click on the taskbar with a right click and go up to search, and then choose to show just the search icon and not the search box. So you'll still have this circle that is the Cortana search icon, and you can click on that and do a search, but it won't be taking up, you know, the room that otherwise could be used for four or five program icons. In the same way that there were possibly some icons in your start menu that aren't something you'll be using every day, there might also be icons on that quick launch area of the taskbar that you don't need regularly. An example would be the Microsoft Store icon. That's like a little shopping bag. You can right-click and say unpin from the taskbar. There might also be an icon for the Windows Mail program. If you use Windows Mail, then by all means keep it there, but otherwise you can right-click and say remove from taskbar. So the idea is to clean up the start menu and clean up the taskbar so those quick launch areas can serve you better. There's one more bit of home page desktop cleanup that we want to do, but we have to do that through settings. So when you click on the Windows icon in the lower left corner, the start menu, you will see a little gear that is just above that icon. And the gear is the new settings interface for Windows. The old settings interface from 10 years ago, probably, the control panel is also still available. There's some overlap between those, so you can perform some functions with either, but there are other functions that are going to be more easily performed with one or the other. And if you're familiar with control panel and the new settings interface is unfamiliar, you might want to just use control panel for a little while and not be frustrated trying to find settings in the new system. But you can always use search in either to find what you're looking for. So for now, we're going to use the new settings interface. Click on the Windows menu and click on the gear. And you'll see an option for personalization. You'll want to click on that. And then in the left column, this is kind of the format of the new system. You basically go into a category like personalization, and you'll see options in the left column. And then what will be displayed are the details for those options. So you've clicked on personalization. Now in the left, toward the bottom of the left column, you'll see one tab or option there, which is for themes. And we're not going to mess with the themes, but go ahead and click on that. And then in the right-hand side, you'll see a link that mentions the desktop icons. So go ahead and click on that link, and a box will pop up that's actually from the old control panel. And that box will let you put a check mark next to computer, because it is helpful to have a shortcut to the computer icon on the desktop. There are a number of things that we might want to do with that. So go ahead and put a check mark, click OK, and now you'll have that on your desktop. There's another tab in that left column, probably two or three below the themes one, and it refers to taskbar. And when you click on that tab, you'll see there are a number of taskbar options, but under a heading called notification area, you'll see some text, which is a link, where you can select which icons appear in the taskbar. Click on that link, and then you'll be given a chance to turn on the ability to show individual icons. You want to make sure all of those are selected to be showing. Initially, it will be turned off, so basically pretty much all of the icons in the lower right corner of your screen near where the clock, the date and time is found, those will be bundled together in a group. And you'll want to go ahead and turn on the ability to see all of those icons individually and not hidden in a group, because there may be important alerts showing up, and there may be unwanted programs that can hide in there, so you don't want those icons hiding. Those are the main things that we'd want to change in settings under personalization and under the themes and taskbar tabs. And then that would set up the computer for the initial appearance of how the desktop is going to look, how the start menu and taskbar will look for you. And as you're using the computer, you'll continue to tweak those things. You'll maybe add items to the taskbar or to the start menu. If you go to the start menu and look at the installed programs that are listed alphabetically that show up in a list there, if you find one that you'd like to have on the start menu and on the taskbar, you can right-click on it and choose pin to start, and then under more, if you've right-clicked on an icon and you see more, you can hover your mouse there and it'll expand and show you pin to taskbar is an option. So you can either add them that way, or if you've launched a program, you'll see its icon in the lower part of your screen. You can right-click and choose pin to taskbar there. You'll notice there isn't an option, I don't believe, to right-click down there and add to start. But in any event, those are sort of the organizational things you'd want to do initially. And going back to the screen capture, you know, that's something you can do just to have as a reminder of how you had the computer configured. So you could go back and reconfigure it again, or if the computer crashed, you'd have a record of how you had your computer set up. And I know sometimes people will use their desktop area to organize icons and have groups of icons based on projects and that kind of thing. Some of the most common tasks that people will be performing on their computer or with their computer would be email and browsing the web and perhaps word processing. So let's talk about those. I'll start with browsing the web because that's where you'll go to get these other things. And Windows will come with the new Edge browser. There may also be an Internet Explorer browser, although that's being phased out at some point. But other browsers like Chrome and Firefox would need to be downloaded. And to do that, you would go to the Edge browser to start with and search for Firefox or Chrome and download them. One thing you'll want to be very careful of is when you're downloading software, there are a lot of unscrupulous, misleading, and malicious websites that will pretend to be the site you want to get the software from. Sometimes it could be one of the top links that show up in a Google search. Could be an advertiser that's trying to get you to download what they're offering. So you want to make sure that you're going to the official websites for these things. For example, with Firefox, you'll be getting that from Mozilla. And with the Google Chrome browser, you'll be getting that from Google. So don't be distracted by or deceived by any of these ads that might be showing up. So you can download Firefox and Chrome, and most browsers today now have the ability to securely store your passwords. They can save your browsing history and bookmarks and synchronize those across multiple devices. If you have a desktop computer and a laptop computer, you can have them synchronized with each other. So that's convenient. To do that with Firefox, you would need a Firefox user account, basically. And with Chrome, the function is provided through your Google account, which is your Gmail address and login. So if you want to use those features, you'll need accounts for those. And Microsoft uses a Microsoft account to synchronize the Edge browser. And since web browsing is often associated with having to remember passwords or write them down, I might mention that there are several different methods of storing passwords. I won't go into the details now. That'll be a topic for another podcast. But you can imagine that having a bound book on your shelf is one approach. The least organized and probably least effective method is having lots of little post-it notes scattered around and falling behind your desk. The bound book is helpful because pages don't get lost. You could also use a three-ring binder and put separate sheets in there, each sheet being for a different account. Other people will put a Microsoft Word document or Excel spreadsheet on a USB flash drive that they only plug in when they're updating or printing their directory of passwords. And there are password managers, software programs that help you manage your passwords. And to be effective, those need to be kind of synchronized across your devices because, you know, you want to be updating or adding a password in the moment on your smartphone or on your desktop or wherever you happen to be. You don't want to write it on a scrap of paper and then tell yourself, oh, when I get home, I'm going to enter that into my password manager. So anyway, those are some different approaches. Spreadsheet, Word document, bound book, whatever. And if you use a Word document, you can have all of your accounts in there alphabetically and even print that out fairly easily. The password management that's built into browsers will remember the website, it'll remember your username, it'll remember the password, but that's about it. It doesn't have any area in there to write down, you know, the three security questions or other details like that. So you do need some place where you're going to keep track of those additional details. And once you've decided on which web browser you're going to use, then you can move on to the next step, which would be to set up the email. And I would say use that next because the third step is going to be installing some sort of word processor, and you may need to have your email up and going when you do that. So for email, many people will just go to Google and click on Gmail and get to their emails that way. They'll just use the web interface, and that works fine for them. Whether it's Google or Yahoo or AOL or Hotmail, they just use the web interface. The advantage of that is that it's fast and it's always available, whatever computer you're on. All of the emails are in the cloud. But some people prefer to use an email client, which is software installed on the computer that lets you go out, get emails, and bring them into your computer. So even if you're without internet, you can still look at what emails you've already downloaded and search for emails from a year ago. All of that will be synchronized on your computer. And common email clients in the past have been Windows email that's built in. There was one that was called Outlook Express, and there have been different names for that, but simplified email clients. A problem with using the built-in Windows email clients is that they unfortunately have changed quite a bit over the years. So if you're building an online saved folder system that's synchronized, then it's still in the cloud. But if you're building a folder system that's locally stored on the computer, depending on what vintage age computer you have, those files may be hard to find and hard to migrate to a new system. Microsoft has an email client called Outlook, which is not to be confused with the email service that they have, which is called Outlook. But it will work quite well although it costs $99 to purchase individually, if it is available individually anymore, and otherwise you would pay $80 to $100 a year roughly for the rental and use of the Microsoft Office suite, which includes Microsoft Outlook email client. There's a free email client called Thunderbird. It's from Mozilla, the Firefox people, and it works quite well and has quite a few features. So you want to pick an email client. You may be familiar with this if on your smartphone you're using email. That would be an email client that's on your smartphone. So it's the same idea for Windows. One of the advantages of an email client is that there are often more features. You can do more, and it basically utilizes the core features of your email service, but then there are added functions such as email rules that you can set up. Email rules are an automated way to sort your emails and take action on them, letting the computer do all that for you. So that's a little bit about email. If you skip installing an email client, that's fine. Just go to the web and do your emails that way. But you'll be dependent on having an internet connection if you take that approach. So if there's any time that the internet goes down and you need to look something up, you're kind of stuck. And finally, let's talk a bit about word processing, spreadsheets, and presentation software. So one of the most common remaining office suites today is Microsoft Office. And that includes Word as a word processor, Excel for spreadsheets, PowerPoint for presentations. And if you're paying this $80 or $70, something like that, to $100, they have different plans. If you're paying that annual fee to Microsoft, you not only get Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, but you get the Access database software and Publisher, which is kind of a nice program for printing calendars or cards or brochures. And you get Outlook and some other things, as well as cloud storage. So recently, and actually within, let's say, the last month, Microsoft has shifted from referring to Microsoft Office as Office 365. Now they're referring to it as just Microsoft 365. So it makes more sense also, because what you're doing is you're signing up to be a Microsoft customer and receive all of these products and services from Microsoft. It's not just Outlook, really. There is still an option to purchase and download with a one-time purchase Microsoft Office for about $140 or $150. But then after a year or two, when you want to have the newer version, you'll need to buy that again. So if you find that 2 or 3 years goes by and you're spending another $150 on Microsoft software, you may have been better off financially just paying the $100 a year. As an alternative to Microsoft Office, there is a product called LibreOffice, which has been developed by volunteers all over the world. So it's similar to Mozilla's Firefox and Mozilla's Thunderbird email client, in that it's been created and supported by and maintained by volunteers. The LibreOffice program can read and it can create Microsoft Office documents. So you'll have a basic level of compatibility, but if you're going to be collaborating on a book, for example, or a more complex document like a newsletter or something, I would recommend using the same word processing program among the team of people who are doing that work. And that will ensure that the layout of the document and the fonts are common across all of the computers being used by the team of people working on that document. But otherwise, if you're doing just basic word processing or basic spreadsheets and you're not collaborating with other people, then using LibreOffice should work just fine. When you go to download and install LibreOffice, you'll notice on the website there's an opportunity to donate. So that project is similar to Wikipedia in that it's mostly volunteer supported, but there are some expenses for overhead. So if you want to donate, you can do that. It's likely at some point you'll want to have cloud storage of some kind, maybe just to share a large video or a collection of photos that are too big to send by email. And there are different cloud services available that offer a free level of user account, and then for more storage and other features, you can pay a small fee. So examples of that would be Microsoft OneDrive, which would be included if you pay the annual fee, but free for up to, I think, 5 gigabytes of storage or something. And Google has the Google Drive cloud, and that's available for free with, I believe, 15 gigabytes of storage. And there's also Dropbox and Box.com and others. So you'll probably want to get set up with some cloud drive, and maybe 2 or 3 if you have more things that you want to store and there's not enough room in the account that you have, if it's a free account. The other reason you might want more than one cloud storage account is because if you're in a situation where you're sharing files with other people and they are using a certain service that they prefer, you'll want to have access to that service to interact with them. But let's start with Google Drive as an example. The most simple way that people will use Google Drive and other cloud storage services is to go to the website, log in, look at files, download files, upload files, share files, and they do that from the web. But there is also client software, sort of like I mentioned earlier with email. There's client software available for cloud storage. And it works very much the same as an email client would. So it synchronizes with the cloud. It makes sure that the files you have in the cloud are also on your hard drive. And if you don't have access to the internet at some moment, then you'll still have access to those files. And any files that you drop into your shared folder, or your cloud folder, I should say, on your computer, those will be uploaded to the cloud immediately, or if you don't have internet access, they'll be uploaded when you regain your internet connection. So it's an automated way to keep your computer synchronized with the cloud. Google offers that software. Microsoft does, Dropbox, Box.com, etc. One thing you'll want to avoid is using the client software for cloud storage if you don't really need it, because it's just an extra task that your computer has to be running and managing. And if you're really not using the cloud synchronization, there's no sense having that software installed and running. You also want to be careful if you're using cloud synchronization and you have a lot of large files out in the cloud, then those large files will be put on your computer's hard drive and take up some room. So there may be files that you just want stored in the cloud. Or let's say someone shares a folder with you and you accept that. Now you have full access to that folder and maybe it has a lot of really large files in it. So those are a few things to consider with regard to cloud services. Definitely something good to have, but the synchronization isn't for everyone. The topic of cloud storage is a good segue into talking about backups. If you do use the cloud synchronization software, it creates a duplicate of all your files, or at least the ones that you're sharing with the cloud that way. And so that can serve as a kind of backup of your data. But if you make a mistake and delete something, it's also going to be deleted in the cloud. So it's not a complete fail-safe, but it's helpful. If your hard drive crashes, the files that were in your cloud synchronization folder will be there. Whether you use cloud synchronization or not, I would recommend getting an external hard drive, the kind that would fit in a shirt pocket that doesn't need an extra power cord, and use that external drive as a backup drive for your Windows computer. There's an included backup program in Windows that will keep track of file versions. And so you'll find that by going to the Start menu and then clicking on the gear icon for settings. And once you're in settings, the last item, security and updates and backups, is what you'll find there. Or you can just search the settings for backup. And there's an option to begin using the backup software and choose a backup drive. The reason to have a local hard drive backup of all of your files is because if your computer were to crash, and if you had a huge collection of photos or videos or music or documents, those things might take a while to restore from some cloud storage. And if it's an external backup using Windows, you could get to your files quickly and easily just by plugging into another Windows computer. And it's good to have redundancy. So that's why I'd recommend having the backup drive. And finally, the last item to be aware of with setting up a computer is to know where to find the updates for Windows. Even on a brand new computer, there will be updates because it may have been sitting in a warehouse somewhere for 3 months or 6 months or whatever. And there have been some updates since it was manufactured. So you'll want to go down to the Windows Start menu and click on that, and then click on the gear to bring up settings. And from within settings, just go ahead and do a search for updates to find the Windows Updates area. And go ahead and click on Check for Updates. Now, it may say, we last checked for updates an hour ago and you're all up to date, but you'll be finding that sometimes you click on that Check for Updates button and there are some additional updates that it, for some reason, wasn't aware of. There can also be a situation where you go into settings, bring up updates, and you'll see that it says you're all up to date, and then below that it'll say there's a critical Windows update that hasn't been installed yet. So it's a little bit contradictory. Just want to make sure that you install all of the updates that show up there in that updates area. You'll want to have a good antivirus program in use. There is one included with Windows 10 that works fairly well, but most people will go out and download a free antivirus program or purchase something like Norton or McAfee. And there are many others out there, commercial products. One that I find works well is Malwarebytes. And it's the one that I use to clean up computers that have been infected, despite the fact that the person has paid a lot of money to use Norton or McAfee or Web Root Defender or whatever these Bitdefender ones are, the commercial ones. That's what I get called in to do, is clean up infected computers that got infected despite the fact that they had these bloated, expensive antivirus programs. So Malwarebytes has been around for a long time. They have a free version that you can use to just scan and clean your computer. And then their paid version, which is $40 a year, will prevent viruses from getting into the computer. Now, no antivirus program is 100% guaranteed that it's going to prevent all viruses. And some may be better at others, depending on the kind of malicious software that's attacking your computer. And from 1 year to the next, and certainly over a period of 5, 10, 15 years, you'll find some companies have products that are at the top of product reviews, and then they may fall out of favor a year or two later, and another one takes the lead. An example would be Avast or AVG that have had really good free products in the past, and then they became more and more bloated and causing sort of pop-up advertisements to appear to try to scare customers into buying additional features. And so those would have been products in the past that I might have recommended, but once they changed their marketing approach and the software became less effective, I stopped recommending those because I would get phone calls from people saying, hey, this software is popping up and asking for this or that. And it was a disruption to their day. And I just wanted something that would be a little bit lighter and not as disruptive. So Malwarebytes has been pretty good about that. Well, those are the main tasks that I would perform or suggest for others when setting up a new Windows 10 computer. The organizing of the home screen, what I'm calling, say, the home screen is the desktop, the taskbar, the start menu, etc. Making sure you get your browser installed and configured. Making sure you have some email account that's either accessible through the web or using an email client. Choosing a word processing and Office suite of software, either from Microsoft or the LibreOffice. And then finally, setting up your cloud services and backups for your day-to-day operations. And from there, you'll have your own specialty software and things that you'll need that aren't common to other people as much. So you may have a printer that you need to set up and things like that, but that can be discussed in another podcast. So for now, thanks so much for listening, and I appreciate all the subscribers, the people who share the podcast with others, the likes, the comments. And I look forward to sharing more with you again soon. Take care.